Today is April 12, 2017, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Philip Alexio in Washington. Coming up, Russian President Vladimir Putin meeting with visiting U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. President Donald Trump says the United States is not going to become further involved in Syria despite ordering last week's missile attack. The end of the Guinea worm disease, thanks largely to intervention overseen by former President Jimmy Carter.
So it was kind of an insult to say this disease comes out of your pond.
It's all ahead on today's International Edition. Russian President Vladimir Putin meeting today with visiting U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, even as Putin said Moscow's relationship with the United States has deteriorated since President Donald Trump took office 3 months ago. The Russian leader talked with the top U.S. diplomat after Tillerson sparred with Russian Foreign Minister Sergey Lavrov about Moscow's support for beleaguered Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and last week's U.S. missile attack on Syria in response to its use of chemical weapons in an attack on civilians. University of Denver International Relations Professor Jonathan Edelman tells VOA's Victor Beatty that despite global condemnation of the attack, there is no way Russia will abandon the Assad regime, at least in the short term.
If you look at it from a Moscow perspective, from that of Sergey Lavrov, the foreign minister, as well as Vladimir Putin, there's no reason to give up. They're winning. This is very important. The real issue for them is not whether or not they keep Assad. They keep Assad for the short run, and then they dump him as a liability once they reestablish the regime. And they've made it fairly clear off the record that's what they intend to do. But the real issues that they've got to deal with from their perspective are different. What do they do about Iran? They don't want an Iranian-dominated Middle East, and yet this is exactly what we're beginning to see. And what do they do about Turkey, which is a NATO ally, but nevertheless has been increasingly alienating the United States? And then what do they do about the Sunni Arab countries that have been really leaning towards them, have been, for example, Egypt's bought $2 billion worth of Russian weapons. The Israelis talk on a regular basis. Bibi Netanyahu's been to Moscow 5 times in the last 20 months. So they've got some really critical decisions to make, but it isn't just about Syria, because that's the easier one. You get it reestablished as a country, you let Bashar Assad stay for some minimal amount of time, and then, to the great relief of the Westerners, you dump him, but the real power, as it was before with Assad, are the people around him. But the issues from Moscow's point of view are, what are we out to do here? Now that we're back in the Middle East, who are we going to side with? Because you can't be on the Iranian side and the Turkish side and then against the Sunni Muslim countries, which recently have been creating almost an entente with the Israelis lined up against Iran. So this is, I think, the critical issue, is to think about it from Moscow's point of view. They've got a way out, but with the West. And the West will take that in a minute. But then they've got the bigger question. If they're going to be the main force in the Middle East until the Americans reestablish themselves, which side are they going to be on?
Mr. Tillerson, before leaving Italy, said Russia failed in its role as a guarantor of a 2013 deal under which the Assad regime promised to give up chemical arsenal. He said it's unclear whether Russia failed to take this obligation seriously and whether Russia has been incompetent, but this distinction doesn't much matter to the dead. We can't let this happen again. Is he putting Russia on the defensive?
He's putting him on the defensive, but the Russians are unimpressed. Lying and cheating goes on among all nations, except the United States, much less than it does that, very little, but a lot of nations do it. And the Russians are major actors in dissembling, and they've done it again.
Jonathan Edelman says whatever the outcome of the talks in Moscow, he's sure that one thing, the Russians are, in the end, realist, and if they might eventually conclude that their interest in Syria and the broader Middle East would be better served without Bashar al-Assad. This is VOA's International Edition. Time now for our social media segment, and of course, joining us is Andrew Pachesky, who is on deck to talk about the all things social media. And we got a number of things on tap today, and they're some pretty interesting stories, and which one are we going to start with first?
Well, I'll start with this. I'll say, what do Pepsi, United Airlines, Sean Spicer, and Cosmopolitan magazine have in common?
Whoa.
Sounds like a joke, one that you wouldn't even know where to begin answering, but all four of those companies, entities, people have been suffering from public relations crises on social media in the past couple weeks. So we've talked about on the show before, Pepsi had an ad where they seemed to glamorize protesting and used it to sell soda. That ad went viral and got pulled. You have United Airlines, that passenger getting dragged off a flight, which we've talked about with our colleague Sarah Williams. They're facing a lot of backlash after that video went viral. And then you have yesterday White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer saying that Adolf Hitler never used chemical weapons, getting skewered on the internet after people pointing out that hundreds of thousands, millions of people were gassed during the Holocaust. And then today, Cosmopolitan magazine, they sent out a tweet earlier today that said how this woman lost 44 pounds without any exercise.
Well, that's terrific, right?
You would think, until you click on the article and find out that it was because that woman had cancer.
Oh my goodness.
And so people saying that that was an awful tweet. The article itself was tone deaf. They said the woman was talking about how she loved her body after some severe health setbacks. These four instances all seem to kind of be a confluence of PR disasters in the past couple of weeks. But because of social media, I think that these are all getting much more attention than they would have any other time. These are being rehashed again and again and again on social media. I can't tell you how many places I've seen that United Airlines video, how many different takes there have been on Sean Spicer's comments. So social media really exacerbates a lot of these problems for these companies and these people.
Now, the Sean Spicer one, if I recall, did he say that Bashar al-Assad's attack was worse than anything Hitler did, something like that? Or
he said that Hitler would never have used chemical weapons against against his people. And so that, you know, getting a lot of attention. And even, to the point of social media finding new angles for these stories, there was a GIF going around of April Ryan, who is a noted White House correspondent, radio reporter. And when Spicer made those comments, it zooms in on her face and she looks up like, did he just say what I think he said? So there's a lot of different angles that people are pursuing with these stories, a lot of different ways they can skewer these companies. And perhaps fittingly, one of the hashtags trending today is hashtag describe social media badly, where people are finding the negatives about social media and talking about them. And one of the things that they're talking about is that everyone will be offended inevitably by something on social media, but everything is under a microscope. All of your missteps will be analyzed and talked about and reanalyzed and talked about again, repeat.
The Hubble telescope looking right at us, and not out to space, and everybody
nothing is private anymore, and anything that we do that is can be even perceived as a misstep is skewered mercilessly on social media.
All right, so you got Pepsi, United Airlines, Sean Spicer, and Cosmopolitan, and gosh knows what's going to be going on tomorrow or next week.
Well, you know, with this trend, I wouldn't be surprised if there were a few more PR nightmares before the week's out.
I'm sure there will be, and that's what you'll be looking for. Andrew Palczewski, everybody. All right, this is VOA's International Edition. Concerns over Syria threaten resurgence of Russian-Turkish tensions. There are some calling for the resignation of the White House press secretary. The Daily Mail settling with the First Lady Melania Trump for $2.9 million, and protesters marching on the South African president's birthday to demand that he resign. Also, the World Food Program estimates 220,000 people could be helped by food convoys. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, despite the heightened inter-Korean tensions over the North's accelerated nuclear and ballistic missile testing and the increasing talk of a U.S. preemptive strike, few South Koreans are actually concerned by the prospect of imminent conflict. VOA's Brian Padden reporting from Seoul that many in the South Korean capital see the increased military posturing as just more political brinksmanship.
Carefree crowds are flocking to Yoido Park in Seoul to see the cherry blossoms at their peak this week. Few here are concerned this region may be on the brink of war.
Well, it is scary to talk about war, as I am from the generation which never experienced war. But I don't really feel fear yet.
North Korea and the United States seem increasingly poised for conflict over Pyongyang's repeated nuclear and ballistic missile tests aimed at developing the capability to target the U.S. mainland. Washington moved a naval strike force led by the USS Carl Vinson into the region over concerns that the North will soon conduct its sixth nuclear test. U.S. President Donald Trump said in a tweet that North Korea was looking for trouble, while Pyongyang warned it would retaliate against American aggression with nuclear weapons specifically targeting both South Korea and the U.S. mainland. The flare-up in tensions, however, is not causing any sense of panic in Seoul, which is situated within range of the North's massive artillery and missile arsenal. Many in South Korea see the current crisis as political theater that has been played out repeatedly in the past.
I have heard similar stories many times before. I think the possibility for war is very low.
Some see the increased U.S. military posturing as a rite of passage for a new American president to demonstrate toughness and resolve.
Every time the U.S. had a new president, we had similar types of crises, but we passed through them without any major struggle.
Ultimately, many in South Korea expect that all sides in the standoff will act with restraint to keep the peace, rather than face the risk of triggering a war that no one can win. Brian Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
And joining us now to talk more about South Korea tensions and what people in Korea might be thinking is VOA Steve Miller, who's actually lived in South Korea, teaching and reporting for a number of years. And Steve, interesting how we feel about the tensions over in South Korea, over in North Korea, here in the U.S. It feels a lot different over here, but what are people going through over there?
Well, it really falls into, I would say, a number of different camps depending on how and what you do in South Korea. So as we heard in Brian Patton's piece, people who live in South Korea, whether you have lived there as a number of years as an expat or as a native South Korean, this is everyday life. You're used to the constant threat of North Korea and the rhetoric on the regime from Pyongyang and the responses from the West, and that's just everyday life. And even in 2010, when North Korea sunk the South Korean ship, the Chunan, that was an instance where over 40 sailors perished. There wasn't a very physical response from South Korea. There was a targeted response, but there wasn't the brinkmanship of war that we sometimes see in the media. Now, there are others who are not familiar with it, who see the rhetoric from Pyongyang, who see perhaps President Donald Trump's tweets and think that this is escalating tensions. And it is, but it's not going to affect those who actually live there, because one of the underlying thoughts is that if there were to be an armed conflict on the Korean Peninsula, the leadership in North Korea would be defeated very quickly, and they don't want to lose their hold on power in North Korea.
Okay. So you've got these missiles launching, making people around the world nervous, but over in South Korea, there are people who are still visiting certain sites that...
Right. So one of the big tourist areas in South Korea is the demilitarized zone, is the actual militarized border between North and South Korea. We saw images of Secretary Tillerson on Conference Row in Panmunjom, the joint security area between North and South Korea, with those blue huts. You can go there as a tourist. I've gone four different times, even with close friends here in the United States when they're coming and visit me. And as of today, they're still holding tour trips to that area. And that's also another way to gauge how serious the situation is for many, is because if tour operators are still allowed to go into this heavily secured area, then perhaps the rhetoric isn't as all it's cracked up to be.
And I don't imagine that, for example, over here, the State Department is telling people not to go over there to South Korea and visit. And
They typically, I still actually get my State Department updates from when I lived over there, and they say be very vigilant, that this is a time of tension. And if tension does get sufficient ratcheted up, they do send out their evacuation plans, and I have received those a few times over the years.
Now, is there any segment over there that is frightened?
I would say people who are new to the peninsula, who aren't aware of or haven't experienced this for a number of years, are concerned. But as we heard in the piece, the more you live there, the longer you live there, the more accustomed you are to this. And whether it's good or bad, you tend to push this off to the back burner.
Of course, all this happening as President Donald Trump sends his armada
right,
with the nuclear subs, as he pointed out in a
the aircraft carrier strike group, which isn't unheard of before, and that strike group, the Carl Vinson, is going to participate in Australian drills later. So it's only there for a short period of time, perhaps to act as a deterrent as North Korea celebrates the 105th anniversary of eternal leader and founder Kim Il-sung on April 15th.
All right. VOA's Steve Miller, also host of VOA's Asia in a Minute. You can catch him anytime you want on voanews.com. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA. A leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Guinea worm is on course to become the second human disease to be eradicated after smallpox, thanks largely to intervention overseen by former U.S. President Jimmy Carter. Little was known about the infection for decades as diseases like malaria took priority, but previously unpublished research from the 1970s released this month shows that the burden that the disease has had on millions of people. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
Guinea worm is contracted when people drink water contaminated with tiny crustaceans that contain the worm larvae. A year later, a meter-long female worm emerges through a painful blister, often disabling the infected person for months. British scientist Brian Greenwood first came across guinea worm in the 1970s when working in northern Nigeria. He says little was known about the disease, despite millions suffering from it across Africa and India.
People are much more concerned with malaria and other bilharzia and other tropical infections. And part of the reason was that these people were so disabled, they never got to the clinic or the hospital. So that if you looked in hospital records, you didn't see this as a big problem.
Greenwood spent 4 years studying the disease and trying to find out why sufferers often got repeat infections without developing immunity.
Often they got a secondary bacterial infection, and if they needed it, had antibiotics. Then we extracted some of the worms, and the traditional way is winding them out on a matchstick, just gradually. And the problem is if the worm then snapped inside, then they got a very severe reaction.
Greenwood credits the Carter Center, a charitable foundation set up by former U.S. President Jimmy Carter for helping to fight the disease to the brink of eradication. There is no vaccine or treatment. Instead, community education programs teach people to filter drinking water and avoid entering water sources. Speaking in 2011, President Carter described the initial difficulties.
So it was kind of an insult to say this disease comes out of your pond. So we've had to do a lot of diplomacy and convincing the people there to take care of their own problems. Well, it's worked. And now almost every nation on Earth has eliminated guinea worm.
When the Carter Center first got involved in 1986, there were around 3.5 million cases in 21 countries. By 2016, just 25 cases were recorded in only three countries, Chad, Ethiopia, and South Sudan. Professor Greenwood's early study of guinea worm lay unpublished for 40 years as he was directed to focus on malaria and meningitis instead. But last year in London, he met Jimmy Carter, who persuaded him to publish.
I hope that we have been able to document what a horrible disease this was. I mean, it really was very, very serious, and it's really important that people realise that. And if we do get eradication in the next year or two, which I hope will be the case, that this really is seen not just to be a minor thing, but to be a really very important public health triumph.
The last few cases of guinea worm remain because they are the most difficult to reach. Many are in conflict areas like South Sudan. But scientists are optimistic this ancient disease can be eradicated within the next few years. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Well, industrial air pollution causing nearly 3.5 million deaths a year, according to a study in the journal Nature. Mike O'Sullivan spoke with one of the authors.
Trade is shifting the costs of pollution, as seen in the example of toys bought for American children, says Earth System scientist Steve Davis.
Usually those things are made in another part of the world, most often China. So by buying something made in China, we're effectively outsourcing the pollution that comes from the manufacture of that product.
Worldwide, air pollution produced by exported goods and services caused more than 750,000 deaths in 2007, the baseline year of the study. Some pollution from eastern China reaches Japan and the Korean Peninsula, causing thousands of premature deaths, and the airborne particles continue to western North America. But airborne particles that result from American and European trade with China caused nearly 110,000 premature deaths in that nation in 2007. The researchers say that as China becomes a consuming society, its manufacturing is shifting, but the pattern is similar.
Some of that is now being outsourced by China into other up-and-coming industrialized countries like Cambodia, Vietnam, India.
And those countries are bearing the health costs.
That's VOA's Mike O'Sullivan, who spoke with one of the authors of that report about industrial air pollution causing nearly 3.5 million deaths a year. This is VOA News.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Admiral Harry B. Harris, Jr., commander of the United States Pacific Command, recently visited Kathmandu, Nepal, to meet with Nepali leaders and to participate in the opening ceremony of a U.S.-sponsored multinational UN peacekeeping exercise called Shanti Prayas 3. Admiral Harris was joined by U.S. Ambassador to Nepal, Elena Toplitz, Prime Minister Pushpa Kamal Dahal, and the Foreign Minister of Affairs, Dr. Prakash Sharan Mahat. The United States is committed to UN peacekeeping missions, mandates, and tasks that support the rules-based international order, a system which benefits all nations, said Admiral Harris. That's why we continue to work together with partners from the countries you all represent. Here, in a center where the motto is Peace with Honor, and involved in an exercise whose name translates as Efforts for Peace, you will enhance our interoperability and engage in a vital, realistic training. Shanti Prayas first took place as a bilateral exercise in 2000 and then expanded so that by 2013, Shanti Prayas, co-hosted by Nepal and the U.S. Pacific Command, became the Pacific region's premier multinational peacekeeping exercise. Shanti Prayas 3 provides an opportunity for participating nations' militaries to train together, building interoperability and establishing good working relationships. Military personnel from Nepal, the United States, Australia, Bangladesh, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Brazil, Cambodia, Canada, Fiji, Germany, Ghana, India, Indonesia, Japan, Jordan, and Kazakhstan participated. Kyrgyzstan, Singapore, South Korea, Malaysia, Mexico, Mongolia, New Zealand, Norway, Pakistan, Paraguay, the Philippines, Rwanda, Sri Lanka, Sweden, and the United Kingdom, Uruguay, Vietnam, and Zambia were also represented. In total, some 68 U.S. service members and 540 Nepalese army personnel joined the exercise, along with 460 personnel from the other participating nations. Ambassador Teplitz said the United States is a proud partner in the production of the Shanti Prayas 3 exercise. Support to peacekeeping falls in line with the United States' goals in the Asia-Pacific region, she said. Peacekeeping affects the stability of regions and thereby can set the conditions where democracy and prosperity can flourish.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.